Welcome to the Leadership Journey Podcast. My name is Alan Wilson, and I'm the host of the podcast. Each week, I'll be talking to various Christian leaders, discussing some of the things that have contributed to the story of their leadership, and at the same time, encouraging you to reflect on your own leadership journey. You can subscribe to the podcast via iTunes. Just look for the Leadership Journey Podcast, and while you're there, you can leave us a review. Meantime, enjoy the podcast. This week, Sir Nigel Hamilton is back. Among the things we talk about are the ways in which Christian leaders can live out their values in the workplace and how leaders can take responsibility for establishing the culture of their organisation. We talk about some of the biblical characters whose stories have been an encouragement to Nigel, and he shares a verse about being old and grey. He talks too about the need for the church to do better in terms of leadership, and he shares four important lessons. Nigel, welcome back to the Leadership Journey Podcast. We've been talking about your early life in Belfast, your education, making that momentous decision to turn down a PhD in psychology in order to pursue a career in the civil service. Now, career in the civil service, you know, by all objective measures, was a very successful career. You mentioned being permanent secretary and eventually actually becoming the head of the civil service. And among, you know, we've talked a little bit about in a way that the challenge for people who find themselves in senior roles, whether it's public roles or in private sector or whatever it might be, puts them in the spotlight, being able to communicate the value base. Can you say a little bit more about that, actually? You know, how would you advise someone in a similar role today? How would you advise them to go about communicating that?
I think, first of all, you have to live it. In terms of what folks see in you, and I think this is one of the challenges for all Christians in those situations. You know, the question that I would constantly ask myself affected is, you know, am I witnessing to my faith? I don't mean in an evangelical
sense.
You're
not evangelizing.
I'm not evangelizing in terms of living it, right? In fact, I came across a poster once, Alan, when I visited an office which said, "Everyone brings joy to this office. Someone they arrive and someone they leave." The question I would ask myself is, you know, what is my reputation? What was my reputation? I also think that the culture that we display is important in our speech, in our behaviours, and how we treat people. So that I mentioned, I think, in our first podcast, the importance of the ministry of encouragement to me. Mm-hmm. If you'll forgive me, I'd like to just quote a little poem on that Derek Bingham introduced me to, which said, "If with pleasure you're viewing anything a man or a woman is doing, if you like them or you love them, tell them now. Don't withhold your approbation till the parson makes oration and they lie with snow-white lilies on their brow. Mm-hmm. For no matter how you shout it, they won't really care about it. They won't know how many teardrops you have shed. If you think some praise is due them, now's the time to give it to them. Because they cannot read their tombstone when they're dead."
Yeah. Of course, he wrote a book called "Don't Wait Till He's Dead," didn't
that's,
he?
And that was the opening chapter of that. Yeah. That's right.
I thought it was a nice, you know, one of the things about Derek in the probably the final year of his life. At the time, I was pastoring in Port Stewart, and we had an opportunity on an Easter weekend where we had lots of visitors, lots of people who knew Derek. We had an opportunity to write a card. A giant card that we made for him. And we sent that to him while he was going through his treatment for leukemia. And I guess I look at that and think, well, that was a nice opportunity that we had to tell Derek what we thought. Mm-hmm. Now, after, you know, sometime after that, Derek came to Port Stewart and asked to speak to the church. And he said, you know, before he'd been ill, his expression was he thought people used to thole him, which is in Northern Irish were put up with. And he realised, with the expressions that various people had made to him, he realised the affection that he was held in. So in some ways, that whole season of his final year or so actually allowed him It was like the message of his own book, wasn't it? People could encourage him.
And also he introduced me to the words of that Stuart Townend song, There Is a Hope.
Oh, yeah.
Which
yeah.
is just wonderful. And, in fact, at a later stage in my life, when I was facing some challenges, medical challenges, I took that with me, you know, because that seemed to me to be the assurance mm-hmm. that we had in our faith.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, let's go back to your career a little bit. And you become, you permanent secretary in the Department of Education.
Department of Education.
Yeah, and then eventually the head of the
That's
civil
right.
service. There were momentous things happening politically. People were emerging into political roles, roles in public mm-hmm. life, who a few years previously, you know, would have been surrounded in a considerable degree of controversy. And you got to meet some of these people.
Yes. The most significant at that time was Martin McGuinness. It was the 30th of November, and I always remember that because it was the evening of our 25th wedding anniversary. And instead of Lauren and I being out in some nice restaurant celebrating it, I was at Stormont when ministers were being nominated. And Martin McGuinness was nominated as the Minister for Education. And I would say, as you would, I'm sure you'd appreciate, as all the listeners might, this was almost to the astonishment of the folk in the Assembly. I hadn't met him before, but we agreed that next morning he would come to Rathgale House, which is the headquarters of the Department of Education in Bangor. So he said he'd be there at 12 o'clock, and at 11:45, I looked out with my senior colleagues, by the way, who were very supportive and agreed we would all go out together. And the world's press and media were outside, obviously because this was a big story. So as the car came in, Martin stood up, stepped out of the car, and I went forward and I shook his hand. And someone said, "Hold that." And this was actually the photograph that appeared in the media and the press and elsewhere of he and I shaking hands. A number of occasions after that, he said to me that the most important thing I had ever done was shaking his hand in public. And I said, "But look, you know, Martin," and I said, "Why?" And he said, "Because, look, I'm a Republican and you're the establishment, you know, and we were sort of coming together." And I said, "Well, look, two things. Firstly, I hope it's just part of my personality that I would be courteous and welcoming anyway. But don't forget, I had hundreds of people looking out the window thinking, what's he going to do?" And it just seemed to me this was a very important leadership moment where I had to show that leadership mm-hmm. and send the message that irrespective of background and reputation, that he was the duly elected minister and we were going to treat him accordingly.
Yeah, yeah. Did you ever get pushed back the other way from that?
No.
No.
The amazing thing was that having done that, I never had one email, letter, phone call of complaint mm-hmm. for having done it.
Mm-hmm. Now, you would probably, in talking about leadership, you'd probably want to use that incident to flag the power of what in some ways is a relatively small gesture. It's a moment. It's a moment yes. in time. But yet it carries a significance. And as you said, you were showing leadership. It's part of establishing the culture, isn't it?
It is, very much so.
Yeah.
And you have, it is very much the culture as part of the behaviour, you know, and in that leadership sense, you know, there are a number of things I think leaders must do. They must listen. They must be courteous. They must be respectful of everyone, no matter who it might be. Maybe I could tell another story, which I...
Please, yeah.
The first day I arrived in Rathgale House as the permanent secretary, I drove up to the gate and the security man was there. Now, I would have to say, you know, his tie wasn't straight and he had a cigarette in the corner of his mouth. And his opening comment to me was, "What do you want?" So I had to explain who I was, and he let me in. And later in the day, I thought, you know, I just need to go and talk to him. So I went back to talk to him, and I said to him, look, I need your help. I said, you're the most important person in that you're the first person that every visitor meets to the office, uh-huh. to the office meets, uh-huh. because you're the security man, and no one gets in without agreeing with you. And I said, I'd like this to be a very warm and welcoming place. Could you help me? He He said, well, that's right, sure. So next morning, I drove in. The tie was straight. There was no cigarette. And he said to me, what are we doing today, boss? but I just think that's important, Alan, in the sense that as leaders, we've got to respect everyone and the role they have. There's a lovely story about John F. Kennedy when he was president, visiting the Space Center. And he was going around shaking hands and meeting folk. And there was a chap with a brush. And he said to the chap with the brush, what's your role? And the guy said, Mr. President, I'm helping to put a man on the moon. I just think the leader has to empower, but also has to respect that everyone in the organisation has a contribution to make, and we have to encourage that to be made.
Yeah. In terms of you going back to your Christian faith, and these are part of your values that are coming through, and that's what we've talked about earlier. But in terms of your Christian faith, would you intentionally have looked at any particular biblical characters or biblical narratives for inspiration?
Joseph.
Yeah.
Joseph was a very much a character. And if you, in fact, I was speaking at a church recently, and I thought it helpful to draw a diagram of Joseph's life, of the pluses and the minuses.
Yes.
And the various things that had happened, because, you know, he was obviously, you know, I'm not boring with the whole sermon, but, you know, he had highs but lows in his life.
Roller coaster.
A real roller coaster. Yeah. And yet he ended up as the chief civil servant in the land, managing things.
Sir Joseph Appleby.
Yeah. but I think I'm sure he brought to that the totality of his experiences.
Yes, of course.
The good things, but also the bad things that he's learned. And between him explaining the dream and then appearing before the king again, it was 2 years. He must have thought in those 2 years, what's going on here?
He must often have thought that.
So I just think that's a lovely biblical story. You know, obviously Daniel is also another story of someone with a very strong faith, living in a culture which was strongly opposing to that faith. And I think there are lessons in there.
Is
as
God
well
still relevant in Babylon? In the Daniel story.
That's right.
Yeah, those are certainly a couple of examples. Nehemiah, I guess you mentioned him.
Yes.
In the previous broadcast, but Nehemiah again, you know, although he's known for his rebuilding work in Jerusalem, yet he'd risen to a very influential place in the court of the King of Persia.
And just something that I hadn't realised recently when I read the story of Nehemiah, Nehemiah 2, when the king said to him, look, you're looking very depressed and down, what's wrong? And it actually says, after a quick prayer, I replied.
Yeah.
And I just think, I can imagine many situations in which Christians find themselves where they're asked, you know, about something difficult, something sensitive, something personal. And we would probably say, Lord, please give me the words to say, as Nehemiah did. You know, so I think this concept of a quick prayer, actually, I think it is really inspiring and valuable.
Yeah, I think there's some really great stuff here, Nigel, for folk who are leading, you know, outside of what we formally call church. There's a number of things that you're saying here, and I think pointing to that kind of thing and the relevance of God in those moments and in those situations. You eventually retired, having become the head of the civil service.
Yes.
What year was that?
I retired in 2008, having served for 6 years.
Right. And it was just a few years after that then that you went through something of a personal crisis of health.
Yes. I mean, when I retired, I chaired a charity and I had a number of board appointments, which was good. And then in 2010-11, I was the president of Ulster Rugby.
Okay.
It was quite awful, Alan.
Oh.
Because when you're the president, you have to go to every match home and away.
And you don't have to buy your own ticket.
And I'd been all around. I'd been in Europe and Scotland, Wales, everywhere with the Ulster team. And it was wonderful privilege, great insight. But I after a conversation with my GP, a new GP, and she asked me in a quick discussion if there'd been any incidents of serious health issues in my family. And I told her the story about my father that I mentioned in our first podcast, as a result of which she sent me to be checked. And the result of it, I went to a lovely, lovely Christian consultant, a chap called Jack Lee in Belfast City Hospital, who said, this will take 10 minutes. And he came back an hour and a half later with what I would only describe as a clinical face and said, you know, if you can imagine a rectangle being the shape of my bowel, I had growths in various different places. So, to cut a long story short, I had surgery. The week after Lorna handed over the school's cup on the 17th of March, a week late, which is the only thing the president's wife is required to do, I had major surgery and lost 60% of my bowel. Mm. When they did the tests, a number of those polyps were precancerous. In June that year, I was told that if I hadn't have had surgery, by Christmas, things would have been sinister. Wow. You know, so listen, I'm in a great place. My health is excellent. Mm-hmm. I've got several excellent consultants, but I hope that since then I've just tried mm-hmm. to, you know, live life mm-hmm. To the full, share my faith, share my stories, encourage others. Mm-hmm.
Can I just stay on the illness for a moment? Was it during this time you mentioned the song "There Is a Hope"?
Yes,
the Stuart Townend song. That was something that
when I went into the hospital, and Lorna said to me, you know, this is an interesting challenge as a Christian. And what I did was I actually took with me copies of that song, "There Is a Hope." Mm-hmm. And you know, I had opportunity to share with one or two other folk in the ward and elsewhere. And when they said to me, like, what do you believe? You know, what drives you in your life? And I said, look, it's in the words of this song. Wow. There is a hope that, you know, I just find, you know, tremendous, and still do. And
how do people respond then when you're sharing that with them? Because presumably some of these people are fellow patients at the time.
Yeah. I would like to think I did it graciously and courteously, you know, because not everyone shared the same faith, and indeed not everyone had the same prognosis that I was given at the time. What was also lovely, by the way, when I was in the ward, was that my dear friend Harold Miller, who did an earlier broadcast, came to see me. In fact, I never forget, you know, the curtains came back and he popped through. He said, so you're here. He said, I've been all over this hospital looking for you. I don't think I'll try as hard the next time. But he came, and I was in a ward with three other people. Uh-huh. And I asked Harold if he would quietly, and Harold went and prayed with each of the others in the ward, which was very important because mm-hmm. one of them sadly had been given a very bleak prognosis at the time. And I just thought it was a lovely thing to do. And mm-hmm. the chap, you know, said, in fact, when he left, he said to me, who was that? And I said, that was Bishop Harold. And he just found that mm-hmm. quite a loving thing for Harold to have done.
Yeah. So retirement then has been, you've been 10 years retired.
Yes.
Now, our mutual friend, Fanta Clark, of course, doesn't call it retirement. He's got his own word for it.
He called it refarm.
Have you got one of his stickers? No,
he gave it to me.
I'm too young to have any of his stickers, but I know that I heard that he actually had a second batch printed, given out so many of these things. But you've mentioned boards and charities and
yes,
you've kept active.
Yeah, I'm not the sort of person who could sit in the corner with my mm-hmm. with my carpet slippers. Mm-hmm. So I chaired the Bryson Charitable Group. I was on the board of the airport and the bank. The thing that I really loved immediately after my retirement was chairing the Prince's Trust, mm-hmm. Because that was an opportunity you know, to give back. And also, to be honest, Alan, you know, to change lives of young folk. And by the time I stepped down, we had something like 7,500 young folk every year through our programs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, quite an emotional experience to hear some of their stories. So mm-hmm. I love doing that. And then I'm almost in the third phase now, because having worked to 2008, then I had those four or five things that I did up to 2016, 17. Now I chair New Irish Arts.
Uh-huh.
Which is great.
We've had Jonathan on the podcast here a little while ago. In fact, he sat just where you're sitting. I think when we were recording the interview. And recently we were both at an event in the City Hall called Greater Love. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, just my role, by the way, is just to ensure, the role of the board is to ensure that the governance is right and the finances are right,
yeah,
to free up Jonathan to do the creative.
Make sure the music's right.
To make sure the music's right and the ministry is right. Greater Love is an event to commemorate and share things from the First World War. When we started it in 2014, we actually needed to raise some money, and I took it upon myself with Jonathan. We went to a number of sponsors who were very generous, so we raised sufficient money. Greater Love is a story of, in songs and readings, from different times during the First World War, you know, things that folk would remember, like Pack Up Your Troubles, etc. But then, quite powerfully, letters that have come back, that came back, mm-hmm, from serving soldiers who were relatives of folk in the choir and the orchestra. Mm-hmm. A wonderful script written by Etta Halliday.
Mm-hmm.
Very powerful. It has been, the Greater Love presentation has happened 15 times,
mm-hmm,
all over Northern Ireland and in all denominations. The amazing thing is that each time it's presented, say, so, you know, for example, if it was in a council area outside Belfast, the illustrations and some of the letters we used would have been from folk who originated in those areas.
Yeah.
So everything was done in an appropriate way.
Yeah.
The wonderful thing about last Friday night, Alan, was that the finale of Greater Love was in the City Hall, hosted by Deirdre Harge,
mm-hmm,
the Lord Mayor, who obviously is a member of Sinn Féin, in front of about 450, 500 people. And yet a powerful production in this year, which is the 100th year of the end of the war.
Mm-hmm.
But not in any sense jingoistic or nationalistic.
No, no.
Very personal and powerful, and I thought very well presented.
Well, when it's focused on stories like that, you know, people, in a way, it doesn't really matter. I shouldn't say that. It's not that the politics of it all and the global, mm, picture doesn't matter, but stories draw people in.
They do. They do. And that's one of the great things that New Irish have done, and Jonathan and Etta Halliday and others, that, you know, they're very creative. But it's also a different way of presenting the gospel.
Yes, it is.
Because there was a very important faith dimension to this as well.
Having been there, it was extremely well done. The whole, you know, the term Greater Love, obviously taken from what Jesus said and the pointer to his sacrifice. We should probably give him a plug, Nigel, shouldn't we, and say,
oh yes,
you know, get online and book your tickets for the Ireland and Christmas
Ireland praise and Christmas praise on December. the 20th and the 21st of December. Yeah.
Jonathan will be really pleased that we've plugged it.
It's a great. It's also a great opportunity to celebrate Christmas.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not a concert, because there's lots of audience participation, etc.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm, yeah.
The other thing I should maybe say too, Alan, maybe if I might, is going back to the boys' model.
Yes.
You know, if I have bookended my life in terms of my medical point with my father. It's also that a number of us have set up this bursary fund in the boys' model, and that again is again very fulfilling to encourage young folk to go to university. This year, one of the, by the way, the boys' model has been is very successful as a school. The percentage of boys who get A star to C's and A levels, etc., is way above the Northern Ireland average. It's terrific. But this year, just to illustrate the point, one of the boys and his mum came to talk to the careers officer after the A-level results came out. And the careers officer said, well, now you've got the grades you need to go to university. And his mum said, well, look, I'm not... we're concerned about the finances. To which they said, well, I've got good news for you. Because if he goes to university in 2 weeks' time, we'll give him a cheque for £1,000 this year and next year and the third year. And that was a tipping point in terms of his decision.
That's great. That's great. Have you found then also in terms of speaking engagements, speaking to groups and so on, that because of the career that you've had, are you finding great opportunities for influence?
Yeah, it's been tremendous. I'm driven, Alan, by... Psalm 71, verse 18, which says, even though I am old and grey, O Lord, do not forsake me until I have passed on your glory to the next generation.
Somebody write that on your 70th birthday card. No, say it again. Say it again. Because let's make it a serious... is a serious point.
Yes.
Read it again.
Psalm 71, 18, which says, even though I am old and grey, O Lord, do not forsake me until I have passed on your glory to the next generation.
Oh, right, okay.
And I have opportunity, for example, a fortnight ago, Evangelical Alliance asked me to kick off the first evening of a new leadership program for young Christian leaders. I've done the same in terms of leadership with some folk in the medical profession. And it's interesting, and I do a number of breakfasts. I'm doing a prayer breakfast this week where someone asked me to come and speak. And basically, you know, I like to tell some of the stories that we've shared today and on the last occasion, but also draw out of that my basic Christian faith, which is what drives me and sustains me. And so for as long as I have health and strength, if folk are interested in that, I'm very happy to share. And one of the reasons I'm delighted just to share that with you, you know, because we've talked on many occasions in the past, you and I, about the importance of Christian leadership. And I just think we need, as a church, as churches, to have even more emphasis on that, and also try to equip not only leaders, but, you know, different folk in their life in the world.
Can I ask you, as someone who's pursued your professional leadership outside of the church and learned things, and we'll get to your leadership lessons in a moment, but from that vantage point of having learned so much outside of the church because of that role and yet being a part of the church, what would you say to churches about leadership, or to church leaders about what they should be cultivating or trying to develop?
I think churches are missing something in terms of leadership. And let me illustrate. If a church has a new building project, they're very good at using architects and accountants to work out costs, to work out borrowings, to work out how much they need over with having a business plan to do that. Okay, because those are the skills the professional people bring, and those are the skills that exist. But we don't always do that in the other programs and the other objectives in the church. You know, one of the early lessons I learned was to make sure that everyone is signed up to and quite clear about what it is we're trying to achieve. Because unless I think you have that, you know, it's a verse from Proverbs which says, without a vision, the people perish. Now, by talking about vision, and I'm not talking about something that's 20 or 30 or 40 years away, or revelation.
Yeah.
I can only do 3 or 5 years in my analysis and my working. If you wanted a different quotation that I think is very helpful, in his poem Curate Troy, Seamus Heaney says, "Believe that a further shore is reachable from here." That triggers in my mind sort of Our Lord in the Sea of Galilee, trying to get to the other side. Believe that a further shore is reachable from here. And I think within the church and leadership, we need to make sure everybody's quite clear within each parish, each church, each etc., what it is we're trying to achieve and how it is we're trying to do it. And thirdly, what is the precise role of the individual? Rather, because if not, we simply go through the motions of keeping things going without really asking ourselves, why are we doing this?
Well, listen, last few minutes, let's imagine that around this table there's a group of eager young leaders with notebooks, and they're wanting you to tell them the top 3 or 4 things that you've learned about leadership along the way. What would you say?
It's probably come out in our two discussions. I think there are 4 dimensions of it. The first one is have an absolutely clear understanding of what it is you're trying to achieve, and keep fixed on that. Secondly, I think you've got to also work out how it is you're going to move from where you are to where you want to get to. Some sort of plan, and a plan that has to be realistic and understandable and achievable. The third thing is the people dimension. What is the role that each individual person plays? What are you expecting them to play individually and collectively? And fourthly, you know, and I've emphasized this, I think, substantially in our chats, is the value base.
Yeah.
You must have that value base and retain it. Now, it will be challenged, but, you know, the value base, you know, are kingdom values that you translate into words and understandings that folk would have around integrity. You know, again, as a secular quotation, but I found it very helpful. Samuel Johnson said, "Integrity without knowledge is weak and useless, but knowledge without integrity is dangerous." And I think holding on to that integrity, that respect, you know, and folk will respect you for that value base and know you by your behaviour and the culture that's established. And I think, and you know, sometimes we get carried away with definitions. You know, culture is simply, how are things done around here?
yes, a nice simple definition. But that's a big leadership responsibility.
The leader has to establish that monitor it and maintain it and continue to encourage.
Of course, that other saying, I don't think anybody really knows who first said it, but culture eats strategy for breakfast.
Yes, absolutely.
You can have all the strategy in the world, but if the organization's culture or the church's culture doesn't support it, it's futile.
And if we spend our life in criticism and critical mode, you know, that just drags us back, you know. And I've learned that, you know, from sport, from work I've done on, you know, in boards and in the civil service. A critical culture, you know, just undermines everything. An encouraging positive culture with a clear goal, you know, it makes for a much better, more positive, more contented and more successful organisation.
Well, that's it. And it reminds me of something I was reading this morning. In 1 Thessalonians, it talks about rejoicing always, talks about praying without ceasing, and it talks about in everything give thanks. I mean, that's the call for Christian leaders. Call for Christian, for all kinds of Christians, but the call for Christian leaders, isn't it?
It is.
Not always easy to attain, but that's what we're called to.
No, we are indeed.
Yeah, Nigel, thank you so much for taking the time, sharing with us, for all that you've brought, and God bless you as you continue to do the various things that you're involved in. Right. Thank you.
Not at all. Pleasure. Sorry, just one postscript, and I meant to say, in all of this, Alan, and everything I've done, I've had a hugely supportive and encouraging wife and family. Okay. I couldn't have done half the things I've done, not least because some of the jobs have been quite demanding, without that supportive family. I think it's important to acknowledge that publicly as well.
Thank you, Nigel. Thank you. Thank you to Sir Nigel for being with us on these two episodes of the podcast, and thank you too for listening. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, and remember that you can post a review. The podcast is back next week with something of an international flavour, when I'll be talking to Clive Atkinson. Clive is the chaplain of All Saints Anglican Church in the Swiss town of Vevey. Be sure to join us for Clive's story. And in the meantime, God bless you and have a good week.